This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, it's Hamish here. We're about to hit the emergency podcast button. We haven't actually done that before on this podcast, but as you've probably noticed, some wild stuff is unfolding in Russia right now. We were actually just about to announce some really big news for us, that we're making season two of Take Me to Your Leader. We'll have more about that very soon, but the figure that we were planning to launch season two with is none other than Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner Group. Not a head of government or state, as you'll know, but nonetheless a figure of huge influence in the world right now. He's a former hot dog vendor from St. Petersburg who went on to build a powerful private army, an ally of Putin's who then turned his sights on Moscow, sparking the biggest crisis in Vladimir Putin's presidency, probably to date. This is Take Me to Your Leader, an emergency podcast episode on the man they call Putin's chef, Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Sure, Dmitry Aperovich, chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a geopolitics think tank in Washington, D.C., and a host of the Geopolitics Decanted podcast.
My name is Monica Attard. I am the co-director of the Center for Media Transition at UTS. I'm also a former foreign correspondent stationed in Moscow.
And we spoke to you when we did our Putin episode. You're back.
I'm back.
And later in this episode, I'm going to introduce you to a Kremlin insider. They're pretty hard to track down, but someone that has worked with Putin and can talk about what this all means for the Russian president. We'll meet him later in the episode. But first to Monica and Dmitry. Dmitry, we've been watching everything unfold in Russia in recent days. I'm personally transfixed by this whole thing. Who is this guy, Yevgeny Prigozhin?
So Yevgeny Prigozhin started his career as a criminal. He grew up in St. Petersburg in the 1960s, and when he turned 18, was caught doing robberies of apartments in St. Petersburg. Now, because he was 18, he was kind of given a slap on the wrist, but then decided to continue his criminal career. And a few years later, in 1980, was finally convicted for and sent into the Russian prison system for 10 years. Left in 1990 and went into business. Initially, he became a hot dog vendor, then graduated into more high-end restaurateur jobs, opening up a number of what apparently were very nice restaurants in St. Petersburg. And that's where he ran into Vladimir Putin, who, of course, was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg at the time. It is said that the two had met when Putin was thrown a birthday party at one of Prigozhin's restaurants and liked it so much that he continued to visit it on occasion. And when Putin became president of Russia in 1999, Prigozhin leveraged his connections to Putin and he got a number of catering contracts in Russia with the Russian government, serving lunches at schools across the nation, then graduating into connections with the Russian military, providing, again, food for the troops. And early 2010s, he had another opportunity, which is to create a private military company, because at the time, the Russian military was looking at opportunities to do what they thought was mimicking the U.S. They were seeing all these reports about the Blackwater private military company that the U.S. was using for protection of its forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. They thought in their usual conspiratorial ways that perhaps CIA was doing a lot more with Blackwater and that, in their view, staging color revolutions across the Middle East and Egypt and Tunisia at the time. And they decided that they needed their own. And Prigozhin, who already had contracts with the Russian Defense Ministry, raised his hand and said, you know, I'm a food supplier, but I can do this too. And that's how Wagner came about. Since creating it as an offshoot of the Russian intelligence service, military intelligence service, the GRU, he has executed deniable operations for them in Africa and later in Syria and Libya and in Ukraine itself since Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014. But of course, when the major second invasion began in 2022, he was again needed to come in and effectively step in when the Russian offensive force was dismantled by the Ukrainians in their original attack on Kiev. And Prigozhin, again, with his Wagner group, stepped in and continued the attacks in the Donbas and fought there for about 10 months until he was able to take the city of Bakhmut earlier last month. When I say take it, he mostly destroyed it, but nevertheless achieved a significant political victory for Putin.
Monica, it was 2014 that the Wagner Group, we think, was established, but alongside a Russian army officer, Dmitry Utkin. The Wagner Group name comes from a call sign allegedly used by Utkin, which was a reference to Richard Wagner, which of course has links to the Nazis because of Hitler's sort of predilection for it. How do we piece all of that together and understand who Prigozhin is and where he sits in the world and where he is ideologically?
Well, I think where you place him ideologically is by looking at his actions and his words. I mean, Prigozhin's current ideology is kind of opportunistic in many ways. I mean, there's been money to be made, and so he's cashed in on that, and he's done the bidding of a man who he likes Putin. One of the things that struck me on Saturday was the public outpouring of, you know, support for Wagner and for Prigozhin. You know, people saying that, yes, you know, finally there's a chance to kind of overturn Putin and this will be the end of the war in Ukraine. And there has been no bigger supporter of the war in Ukraine. This is a man who has executed his role in that war in a really vicious way in order to deliver Putin a political win.
And so what is Wagner Group, Dmitry? Is it a mercenary army in the sense that we might understand it, a gun for hire? Wouldn't it need to have other clients other than Putin and the Russian state if it was a genuine mercenary army?
No, and this is an important thing to understand, that Wagner Group is a creation of the Russian military intelligence, of the GRU. It is completely beholden to the Russian military, not just as its only client, but also as someone who is providing all of the funding, because these people need to be paid. And you can bet that Prigozhin is not paying them out of his own pocket.
So where does the money come from?
From the Russian Ministry of Defense.
Which has been what Prigozhin has been so upset about in the last year, that he believes that the MOD is not actually giving him the weapons that that he deserves and that Wagner deserves in order to fight the fight that they're asking them to fight. I mean, that has been the crux of the problem here.
But isn't there also some history of the Wagner Group going into places, whether it's in Syria or Libya or Mali or Sudan or other parts of Africa, and actually seizing control of some of the state assets or the natural resources, commodities, and taking a cut of that to continue funding their operations?
It's not clear where that money went to. Certainly it's possible that part of those funds from mining concerns that they've taken over and bribes that they've taken in Africa have gone into funding operations of Wagner. I think a much more likely alternative is that they actually went into Prigozhin's pockets.
Wagner has performed a number of different functions for Russia abroad. You know, it can do anything from providing bodyguards to helping reinforce insurgencies to planning dud elections. I mean, it has a number of shady operations and resources that it can pull at. But the important thing to note is it's not always paid in cash. I mean, sometimes it can be in resources, you know. It can be a cut of this gold mine or a cut of that gold mine. The money comes in various different forms. And because, of course, we have no insight into any of that and where and who are on those registers and where that money is going, we don't know. It could be more than just Prigozhin who is benefiting. In fact, I would be astounded if it were just Prigozhin who were benefiting, if there were not other members of the Russian government who also had their finger in those various, you know, pies. But he has served a very, very useful function for the Russian government in providing services to a number of, you know, tin pot autocrats around the world.
Prigozhin reportedly worth $1 billion. Dmitry, does that ring true to you?
You know, it's impossible to know, but he certainly has a wide range of interests, business interests, and Wagner is only one of those.
Dmitry, when was the first time you came across Prigozhin? You've got a background in cybersecurity.
I first came across him in the early 2010s when one of his other entrepreneurial endeavors, the Internet Research Agency, essentially an online troll factory, came to the fore as the people that were engaging in online disinformation, going into various social media sites and comment pages for news sites and trying to propagate a fake narrative that was generally pro-Russian and pro-Putin.
In terms of the incredible events that we're witnessing unfold in Russia right now, Monica, Putin has given two televised speeches in response to what Prigozhin's attempted to do. But in the latest one, he's described Prigozhin's actions as treasonous. The Kremlin says that it's still investigating Prigozhin for mutiny, despite other reports suggesting that criminal charges would be dropped, that he'll just be allowed to go and have a happy retirement in exile in Belarus. How do you interpret what is going on and what the state of the relationship is between Prigozhin and Putin?
Well, I dare suggest not very good at the moment. I think, you know, in the heat of the negotiations on Sunday and the coverage of them, perhaps that's where this line that the charges would be dropped has kind of filtered through. It's still very murky. We really don't know. But it's certainly pretty clear now that the investigation has not been abandoned. That's not only been reported by Russian media, but Putin has virtually confirmed it in the second speech. I mean, his second speech I thought was really interesting, actually. From what I hear, Moscow is absolutely buzzing with rumour about what is going on, whether Putin is actually still there or has fled. I mean, people I was speaking to yesterday were running these rumours by me and blowing my mind, frankly. I mean, they were really kind of wild and out there. So I'm not surprised, in a sense, that he came out to address the people again. He kind of hit on some of the big points that have been picked up by Western media and Western analysts and Western governments in particular, for example, in relation to the lack of resistance that Prigozhin faced on his little journey up from Donbass to the outskirts of Moscow. You know, the lack of resistance, Putin says, was pre-planned to avoid bloodshed. You know, I think that it's fairly safe to say that that probably is not the case, that there was a lack of resistance, particularly in Rostov-on-Don, because that is simply the way the military hierarchy operates, that they were not going to round him up and do something with him, arrest him, kill him, boot him out, because Prigozhin does carry a level of respect in the upper echelons of the Russian military. But also they weren't going to, you know, lay down and let him do whatever he wanted or take over completely or give in to him, because they would have been waiting for the phone call from Moscow to tell them what to do. So, I mean, the fact that there was no resistance, I think, is a really, really, really complex issue. The other thing I thought that was really interesting about what he said was that the Wagnerites can now choose between remaining with Wagner or coming to the MOD, which seems to me to be saying that Wagner will cease to exist as an entity, at least in Russia and Ukraine, that it might well continue to exist internationally, but that on Russian and Ukrainian territory, it's no longer a force, that its troops will be either reincorporated into the MOD or they disappear.
Prigozhin, Dmitry, seems to be asserting that somehow this was not an attempt to unseat Putin, that this was actually an act of loyalty to the state and to the leadership of the state, and that his target really was the military leadership. Can that be believed?
Yes, well, at least partly. So I don't think that Prigozhin actually wanted to orchestrate a coup at all. I don't think he wanted to take power. He has no power base in Russia. So even if he had managed to succeed successfully and get to the Kremlin and, you know, arrest or kill Putin, he would be faced with the question of then what? He definitely did not want to be the dog that would catch the car. But what he did want, and he actually admitted this today in the audio message that he put out, that the catalyst for this whole operation was this June 10th decision by Defense Minister Shoigu to dismantle all private military companies within Russia, including Wagner, by July 1st, where everyone would be forced to sign contracts with the Russian military, effectively no longer becoming mercenaries. And Prigozhin right away said that he was not going to obey this order. And I think this was an act of desperation to try to pressure the state, and particularly Shoigu and Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, to rescind that order and to continue to let him run Wagner.
Just on that, though, I mean, as someone who claims to be loyal to Putin, he's not naive enough to think, is he, that this doesn't destabilize Putin and make him look weak internationally?
I think he actually was. And if you look at what he's been doing over the last 6 months, you can sort of get an idea of how he might be thinking that. Because for 6 months, he's had this very public feud with Shoigu, where increasingly, he was blaming Shoigu for the disaster of the war. He was blaming him for not supplying Wagner with ammunition and sufficient weaponry. He was ranting against him in front of dead bodies, claiming that he was responsible for those losses of his soldiers. And Putin, throughout all of this, did not interfere. Stayed out of this, basically deciding that as long as his underlings are fighting, he is more secure and more powerful because no one can get strong enough. So Prigozhin kept upping the ante, kept getting more and more desperate, kept provoking Shoigu. Finally, Shoigu retaliated in a very bureaucratic way by signing this order, dismantling Wagner and other PMCs. And Prigozhin decided to take this hot-headed action of trying to roll into Rostov and occupy a military headquarters of the Southern Military District, which, by the way, is the nerve center where Russian military runs the war in Ukraine. I think he was shocked when Putin came out and actually called him a traitor and was visibly angry at this assault on him and his power.
I'm going to pause this conversation with Monica and Dmitry for a moment because I want to introduce you to a Kremlin insider. His name is Sergei Alekhashenko. He was Russia's deputy finance minister and also the first deputy chairman of the board of the Central Bank of Russia. He's worked up close and personal with Putin, and he knows the way Putin wields power. So I want to understand the dynamic that's playing out right now between Prigozhin and Putin.
Yes, Hamish. Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. Sergei, how well do you know Putin?
Personally, I met him 3 times, and it was last 3 months of my presence in the central bank, so we met. And of course, Putin is maybe the most important political player, if not the only one political player in Russia. You cannot understand what's going on in Russia if you do not watch his decisions.
You know how Putin wields power. How rattled do you think he is by what's unfolding in Russia right now?
He's in rage because he was really surprised by the behavior of Yevgeny Prigozhin, who was not his friend, but who was definitely within his nearest circle, the guy who was ready to do different dirty things for him. And when Prigozhin launched his escapade, of course, it was a great surprise for Putin because it was a violation of all rules and agreements within his environment.
Just on that, if Putin is genuinely enraged, we know his record for taking out his opponents. Why not just get rid of Prigozhin? Why let him go to Belarus?
I think it's a strange combination of interests. Until recently, maybe until the very recent days, Prigozhin's company Wagner was one of the most strong military units in the Russian army during the invasion of Ukraine. In honestly, looking on the biggest achievements of the Russian army in the last 12 months, we may attribute all of those achievements to Prigozhin and to his military troops. That means that he was very useful for Putin. And of course, he could put Prigozhin in jail. It's not so difficult, and Prigozhin definitely was in the hands of Russian securities. But I believe that Putin is interested in keeping Prigozhin as his tool, at least for the moment, in Africa. So he allowed him and his mercenaries to leave to Belarus. And as I understand, President Lukashenko, he promised to establish the legal framework for this private military company.
Okay, so what's going on then right now inside the Kremlin? Because Putin has never really faced a threat or a challenge quite like this during his time in power.
Seems the situation under the surface is not very simple. For example, Moscow mayor declared this Monday as a day off, anticipating that there will be a battle in Moscow or Moscow will be given to Prigozhin. So, and this decision was made in the end of Saturday. So, of course, Moscow mayor could not make this decision himself.
Take us inside the Kremlin when something like this is going on. Like when you say the situation maybe is not as calm as it looks from the outside, what exactly is happening?
For Putin, it's it's a very unstable situation. So though nobody, no one minister, no prime minister, no, neither head of FSB, no head of interior ministry, even Patrushev, his closest friends, the chief of security council, none of them spoken openly in defense of Putin. So I think that Putin will investigate the behavior of many, many people in his environment and will look for traitors.
And so do you think Putin is safe for now?
I do not think that Prigozhin escapade was a real threat to Putin, because in none of his statements, Prigozhin said that he wants to get the presidential power. His demands were modest and really strange. He wanted the replacement of the Ministry of Defense, and he wanted to remove the decision that there is no place for private military companies in Russia. That means that Putin was safe even during the Prigozhin march to Moscow. But for Putin, this situation is instability. Yeah, he understands that it is very simple, very easy to launch such an event if someone will emerge within Russian political elites who would build a coalition to replace Putin. It seems it will not be very difficult.
Sergei, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Hamish. Thank you for your questions. Bye. Good luck.
Now back to Dmitry and Monica. So much more to unpack here. Monica, what happens to Prigozhin now? He's said to be going into exile in Belarus. Obviously, Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, is pretty much beholden to Putin. Is Prigozhin confident that he'll be safe there, or does he perhaps find his way out of a very tall window of an apartment building?
I think for the very first time in about probably 6 months, we can make jokes about people falling out of windows or drinking poison tea and know that it's not a joke. I can't see that Prigozhin lives. I can't see that he survives this. Putin is a man who is on the record. Not only has he said it himself, but via his actions, is a man who does not tolerate traitors. He hates traitors.
But doesn't getting rid of Prigozhin, though, at this point create a martyr of him, given that we know there's some loyalty, at least within those 25,000 or so soldiers that he had on his books in and around Ukraine, given that we know there wasn't all that much resistance to him moving into Rostov-on-Don and then towards the capital, Moscow? Doesn't it risk creating a bigger figure that even in death could be a threat to Putin?
Well, first of all, he won't do it tomorrow. I mean, I think that he'll probably... can I just say, we don't even know where Prigozhin is at the moment. I mean, he turned his tanks back and was heading back down south, but he's not been seen. But on the assumption that he does make it to Belarus, I mean, he's going to be under very, very close scrutiny. Everything he does is going to be very, very closely monitored. But I think that... I don't think that Putin will do this tomorrow, in the next 3 months, but I would say within a year. It would be my rough guess. And in terms of the hierarchy of the Ministry of Defence, I mean, I think that there is a good deal of sympathy there for what Prigozhin has been saying about corruption, about the lines of supply, about the way the war has been strategized. But I don't think that extends to a belief that the leader should be overthrown. I mean, I don't think that there is that push to overthrow Putin. It's anyone's guess. Of course, we're spitballing here, right?
Sure.
Because who knows?
But
who
Dmitry, knows? That's exactly what G7 leaders and European leaders have been doing in recent days, is spitballing possible outcomes. And one of the scenarios it's being reported that they've discussed and tried to imagine is what happens if Yevgeny Prigozhin ends up somehow in control of nuclear weapons. Is that far-fetched?
Yes, I do think so. First of all Russian nuclear weapons, both strategic and tactical, have something called PALs, which are permissive action links, essentially codes that are put on these weapons that would prevent them from being fired by anyone who does not have the codes themselves, which is stored presumably in a very secure location in Moscow. So just even if he had managed to get access to these nuclear weapons, and there's no indication that he has, he would not necessarily be able to launch them.
And do you think he's a spent force for the time being, or do you think that there's more to this story?
I think it remains to be seen, because Wagner was not defeated on the battlefield. In fact, quite the opposite. They've achieved tremendous successes. And how is that going to play out on July 1st when all of these people are supposed to drop their arms and sign contracts with MOD or go home or go to Belarus? So it remains to be seen. I think it's certainly possible that Putin will be able to suppress them and ultimately kill or capture Prigozhin. But I think it's also quite possible that Prigozhin will remain a powerful figure. Everyone in Russia now knows who Prigozhin is. And they also know that this is a man that actually managed to challenge Putin and at least for now get away with it.
Monica, Dmitry, thank you for taking us into this shady, weird world.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So if Yevgeny Prigozhin is still alive and kicking when we kick off season two of Take Me to Your Leader, we'll bring you a broader, more in-depth episode on Prigozhin then. But, you know, let's see, given everything we've just heard. Thanks to my guests, Monica Attard and Dmitry Alperovich, and also to Sergei Alekshenko. This episode was produced by Linda Lopresti. Our series producer is Greg Muller. I'm Hamish McDonald. This is Take Me to Your Leader.